Hello and welcome to Dad Educates Daughter on 80s Music. This is Series 5, Episode 15, the final episode of the women of the 80s.
And of the 80s in general.
And of the 80s in general, yes. And that was Rebecca. Hello, Rebecca.
Hello, Dad. How are you?
So, yeah, I'm good, thank you. So, yeah, the last one, and it's a different one this week as well. It's duets.
Yeah, it is. A lot of them as well. When you were reading about last week, I don't think I took in context how many different people there were.
Yeah, so not a lot of songs.
No. And one thing I'll tell you is because they're duets, and I noticed with some of them it was like a soloist and then someone. I didn't go and listen to where you might have sent me just two songs. I didn't go and listen to any more because I didn't know how long they would have been a duet for, whether it was just a duet for a certain thing or whether it was a duet because it was like a soloist and someone kind of thing. So I haven't listened to any more. I know that like there was a few like Pepsi and Shirley. I know that they were like a thing. So I might have been able to find more, but I didn't want to then confuse it with I've listened to some of these, but I've not done these. So I just left it with the basic what you've given me and gone off purely off that.
Okay, so if I just go through the main one.
Mm-hmm.
So Susan Fassbender,
mm-hmm.
The Reynolds Girls, We Papa Girl Rappers, Sarah Brightman, Romac and Womack, Roberta Flack, Pepsi and Shirley.
I've got to look back now.
Hillary Lester and Kim Appleby.
Mm-hmm.
They were your main women stroke duets. Womack and Womack's probably the only one that's 50-50.
Yes.
So, how many number ones?
I've gone with four.
Any. Four.
But I'm not sure on it because I feel like this could be a week where you turn around to me and go, there was none.
Well, there were some, but not as many as four. There were two.
Okay.
So give me your four.
We'll see whether I get them.
And we'll see if any of them are the two.
So Sarah Brightman has got two.
Okay.
I've gone with The Phantom of the Opera and Time to Say Goodbye.
Okay.
Then Womack and Womack have one.
Mm-hmm.
And that's Teardrops. And then Mel and Kim have one with Showing Out, Get Fresh at the Weekend.
Okay. We shall see if you found the two number ones, or even if you found one of the number ones.
Knowing my luck, I won't find any.
Well, we'll find out. So let's talk music. Let's talk Susan Fassbender.
Yeah. So I'll give you a heads up. There's not much that I've said on many of them because there's only been like one or two songs. So obviously, like with any artist, I don't like to give away what I think of them based on just the song. Like it's quite hard. This one, I was more focused on the fact that you said they were duets and this one came across as just a soloist. So I'm intrigued to find out how they were a duet. Whether I missed something with that, because when you're listening you can't tell as much, and then you watch the video and you see a bit more, and I just didn't really see anyone else with her. And I've gone with her genre of pop.
Okay. So Susan Fassbender, born Susan Wincup. She's from Bradford in England, active since 1980. She's a singer and a musician. She played the keyboard and piano. Her genre is new wave and pop. Sorry, she was also a songwriter as well.
Oh, okay.
So Fassbender, who took her mother's maiden name, as I said, she was Susan Wincup, but obviously her mum's maiden name was Fassbender, and that was her name for her stage name.
Yeah.
So she began studying at 13 on the following. Playing. Classical piano, clarinet, and the kettle drums. And later on, she would also play synthesizer. So she then met guitarist Kay Russell, who would become her songwriting partner throughout her career. So although they're a duet, they're not.
Right. So
Kay Russell was more in the background. She played the guitar, and originally it was just classed as Susan Fassbender.
Yeah.
And then it was later on, it was Susan Fassbender or Fassbender and Russell.
Yeah, with you.
However, the main song that you obviously listened to, that one was just classed as Susan Fassbender.
Yeah. Okay, so
it explains why it came out. I've included it as a duet rather than on its own. One, it was a one-hit wonder in a sense. But two, I think unfairly, Kay Russell got left out.
Yeah, I feel like if you're working with the songwriting and everything, you give it a credit, don't you?
Yeah, and she also played on them.
I was going to say, and they played on the...
So both women wrote lyrics and the melodies together. Prior to their collaboration, Russell was with a poet, Nick Tozick, in a Bradford-based new wave outfit called Ulterior Motives. Fassbender and Russell signed to independent record label Criminal Records and wrote Twilight Cafe, which was released in 1980. They appeared twice on Top of the Pops in January 1981 with a backing band consisting of drummer Gary Walsh and bassist Mike Close. Two further singles were released, Stay and Merry Go Round. However, neither single charted, and Fassbender and Russell temporarily retired from the music industry to get married, not to each other, to obviously.
Oh, right. Yeah,
And Fassbender also raised three daughters during that time that they were retired temporarily. Fassbender married in 1983, and she became Susan Baggio. Further songs were written by both women, separately and together, but no further interest was shown by the record companies in releasing any new material from themselves. In 1991, Fassbender committed suicide. She was just 32. And in 2012, Platform Records released an album of unreleased demos by Fassbender and Russell titled Twilight Cafe, the Demo Collection, 1981 to 1985.
Wow. So she had like enough work behind her to get that out, but she never went anywhere with it.
So they never released an album up till this one, this demo one. And
yeah, I was gonna say, like, they only had like singles, right?
They'd only had one top 40 single, and they had a couple of others that were released, but other than that was it. And I don't know the reason for the suicide, or method was. Obviously, yeah, she had three children at the time. She was only 32. So tragic, really, but you don't know the reasons why. The music industry that, because obviously, as I say, they come back, but they were writing material both together and separately, but obviously nothing. So yeah, bit of a sad ending.
It's a tad.
So 1981, Twilight Cafe, Susan Fassbender, and as I say, I've included Kay Russell. She was part of And it got to number 21.
It's not bad, is it? It was very repetitive, but it was catchy. So it was a good one to open up with. And considering it was repetitive, it weren't like an awful repetitive where you're like, okay, I get the point.
Okay. So we move on to the Reynolds Girls.
Yeah. Again, I only had the one, so I've not written too much about them. I've gone with electropop for them. And I'm not sure what I think of them. Like, you know, because they're duets, I've tried to work out their relation to each other. So I'm not sure about these. I think these might just be friends, but they just seem to be having fun. They seem to be having a good time. And I, with the song they've got, I'm just like, how didn't they do more? Because they looked like they were quite commercial. Like, for the industry, they looked like they were the right kind of people to put on like front covers and album art and whatnot. So I'm wondering how they didn't get put into the spotlight, or whether their music just didn't go anywhere regardless.
Okay, so the Reynolds Girls are Linda and Aisling Reynolds. They're from Liverpool, England. Active since 1989. They are singers and they are pop singers.
Oh, okay. I've got more electro.
So the singers grew up in Sefton, Liverpool, and were of Irish descent. The duo's younger sister, Debbie, played Katie Rogers in the soap Brookside on Channel 4 between 1987 and 89. The sisters signed to Pete Waterman's PWL record label after giving Waterman a demo tape, and their single I'd Rather Jack was produced by Stock, Aitken and Waterman.
Mm-hmm.
So they started out as a response to the music critics who ignored the younger acts in the UK at the time, and to DJs who continue to play older bands on their playlists rather than Stock, Aitken and Waterman's newer songs with newer artists.
Mm-hmm.
So the verse, no heavy metal, rock and roll, music from the past, I'd rather Jack than Fleetwood Mac. So that was their verse that was literally saying you're playing all old songs and not new songs, and then, like, you know, I'd rather Jack than Fleetwood Mac, who obviously was being played but not necessarily had great songs. It was just, it was Fleetwood Mac. They've released a single, and I'm not just Fleetwood Mac, but obviously they're the ones that were quoted, well, obviously, yeah, that fitted in with the verse,
rhyming. I did listen to the lyrics and think they sound like they've got, not beef, but it did sound like it was a little dig.
Yeah, so it's obviously written by Stock, Aitken and Waterman, as they normally wrote their songs, and that's where that come from. So following the perceived snub at the Brit Awards, where Stock, Aitken and Waterman acts lost out to the more mature acts like Enya and Steve Winwood. So the single was a top 10 hit in Ireland, Finland, Netherlands and Belgium. And following the success of the single, the sisters then had a public falling out with Pete Waterman, who accused them of being difficult.
Like divas difficult.
I guess so, yeah. Or it could be just difficult as in working alongside them, you know. The working relationship just didn't work.
Yeah.
The girls then self-released their follow-up single, Get Real, which was funded by their parents who remortgaged the family home.
No.
However, unfortunately, the single failed to chart. So, yeah.
Also, just to side note, so Pete Stockman and Water, Stock Aitken and Waterman, their I thought they were really good in the music industry, but obviously now you're saying that newer upcoming people weren't played as much. So what, their music wasn't always like big hits then with radios and stuff.
The what, sorry?
You know, a Stock, Aitken and Waterman? How you're saying, obviously, like with these, like the lyrics was because they were always like dubbed, like their artists lost out to more mature. So does that mean that people didn't listen to them as much? Because I thought they
not were at first. At first, they like, struggled.
Early on in there.
This is very early on, before Rick Astley, Sonia, and as I'll go, I think we said, didn't we? Was it last week? I can't remember who it was, where someone they had then got ousted because they got Kylie Minogue. Sam Fox, yeah. It might have been. Was it Sam Fox?
Yeah, that rings a bell. It was definitely last week. It was definitely last
week. Yeah, I can't remember who it was.
These Reynolds girls were 1989. So that's late in the 80s.
But then so were Pete Stocks, so were Stock, Aitken and Waterman. But they started off with Pete Waterman on PWL, remember? So it might have been it wasn't Stock, Aitken and Waterman as we know it. It was PWL, Pete Waterman Limited, I think it stood for.
But because they were later on in the 80s, how they then went to mature artists then? Because Rick Astley was already about.
Yeah. I'm guessing, as I say, it was more about them missing out on the Brits.
Right, okay.
Because and obviously airtime with others, you know, they obviously, because they was class at the time. Stock, Aitken and Waterman were very cheesy, it's a bit like when Simon Cowell and the X Factor or whatever it was before that, Pop Idol, I've done it myself, you know, every year Christmas number one would be whoever won that, no matter what, and it was a bit like that with Stock, Aitken and Waterman. They put out a new song and it went to number one. Now, some were good, you know, but there were others that, I mean, obviously, they really started with Bananarama, I think it was, first.
Yeah. So they Stock, Aitken and Waterman were early on in the 80s.
No, they were late 80s.
Oh, yeah, Bananarama weren't like early 80s.
No. They were more mid late 80s, so yeah. But I think that was their first one, this Banana, or at least one of their songs they wrote. And but yeah,
okay, yeah, it makes sense now.
But yeah, they're artists, you know, they, because obviously they had soap stars, not real singers, or not what were perceived at the time as singers, you know. I mean, when Kylie Minogue first came over, she was better known for in Neighbours.
As
an actor or young actress, rather than...
they weren't taken seriously to begin with, I guess.
No. And then obviously they had Jason Donovan. I don't think that Robson Jerome were under them. I think they were actually under Simon Cowell. Sonia, who was an unknown. Rick Astley was an unknown, you know.
Page 13 person from last week.
Who?
Not 13.
Page 3, yeah, Sam Fox.
Yeah, they had her.
Yeah. I think they wrote for Sunita.
Yeah.
She went to PWL, I think it was, after leaving. I think actually it might have been Sunita that was bumped for Kylie Minogue.
That might be the one.
Yeah.
Yes, it was. Yeah. Yes, it was.
So yeah. And I think they were behind Brother Beyond as well, who were obviously later as well. They were like the first manufactured boy band, I think. Well, I say the first, because the Monkees probably were the big one put together by like a record company. But yeah. So they went, as I say, their own way. Their parents remortgaged the family home.
So mad. Imagine.
And unfortunately, it didn't chart.
Imagine you remortgaging your own home for me, and then I just don't bring you any money.
Yeah. Yes. And since then, the whereabouts of the sisters is unknown.
They've gone into hiding. But they've run away from their parents.
Yeah. ITV were searching for them for a commemorative documentary about Stock Aitken and Waterman in 2013. And as of 2022, their whereabouts is still unknown.
No one literally knows where they are in the world. How's that possible, though? How can you just disappear from, like, a whole world?
They need to get the people behind hunted onto them.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Like,
they don't obviously want to be, you know, they had one song. I suppose the failure of their follow-up probably didn't help. Yeah. And they just want to be move on and forget about it sort of thing.
Their parents are fuming and sold them or killed them, and that's why we can't find them.
Well, I'm sure, I mean, yes and no. I mean, they obviously could afford it and would have known the risks.
Yeah, but that's a big risk.
So
it didn't pan out very well, did it?
Well, it's been 25 years since, so they would have paid it back off again by now.
Old grudge, though.
So
they could have paid off their mortgage after the.
I'd rather Jack by the Reynolds Girls, 1989. I was looking at Twilight Cafe there. 1989. It got to number 8.
Oh, okay. It's good. I did enjoy this song. It's got a good beat and the video has got some good dance moves. I think they're just, but like I said, they just come across as people that would have fit in well with like the period, and they looked a bit more 90s as well. Very catchy chorus. I did enjoy that.
Okay. If we move on to We Papa Girl Rappers.
Yeah, so they're definitely wannabe rappers, aren't they? And they're very 80s though, but like, then I also sit here and be like, why are you rapping in the 80s? Like, it just weren't the right time. So I'm wondering whether it was the wrong time for them. Like, maybe they were, if they delayed it a bit, they might have had better hits. But then, all you know, that's just me assuming that this is all they had. Whereas really, they might have continued into the 90s and been bigger in the 90s, I don't know. Because like I said, I didn't listen to any more. So I've gone with rap and hip-hop for their genre. And I do hope that they moved into the 90s so that they could actually find their right fit, because the 80s definitely weren't it for them. So I'm very intrigued at how they hit in the 80s, because this music is just so far from it.
Okay, are you ready?
We
Papa Girl Rappers are Sandra and Samantha Lawrence from London, England. Active since 1987, they're singers, and their genre is pop, hip hop, reggae, and rap.
Reggae? Okay.
Yep.
Okay, but maybe only for one song.
One song's one song, isn't it?
Yeah, it is mad how much these genres can be very like, oh, there's a little bit of a beat that could be a bit of house, so we put house in there as their genre. Oh, it had a saxophone, bit of jazz. Very flaccid with it all, isn't it?
So the sisters were a British female rap duo who were the backing singers originally to Fergal Sharkey.
Really?
Before being signed to Jive Records. So their debut single, Heat It Up, featured two men and a drum machine, with the single charting inside the top 30 on the UK singles chart. Their most successful single was We Rule, which was inspired by both reggae and dancehall music than hip pop and rap, and that reached the top 10 in October 1988. The duo released two albums, The Beat, The Rhyme, The Noise, which reached number 39 on the UK album chart, and then in 1998, while the second album, Be Aware, didn't manage to chart, and that was in 1990, and the duo split in early 1991. Now, when I say split, obviously they were sisters, so I don't know whether it was, I don't think they had a falling out, because I haven't seen it. I think it was just a matter of they just decided music industry wasn't for them, or they'd been released by their record label and couldn't get another one, and didn't have some parents who could remortgage their home. I don't know. You know.
So. What baffles me is how they weren't getting a hit so as early as 1991, but they were so before the time of the 90s. They would have fit perfectly in the 90s, I think.
Yeah, but unfortunately they're up against Salt and Pepper, in a sense, and I suppose they were seen as the poorer relation, the bridesmaids, because Salt and Pepper were big, which is why we've already had them, even though they are a duo. And probably, had I known at the time we was going to do a duo, we'd have probably done it over two series. You know, we could have split it over two, because we've had some others, you know, David Grant, who had most of his songs with others. But Salt and Pepper probably rightly was in the main women's because of the amount of hits they had, whereas we Pepper Girls had two.
They've had loads anyway, haven't they?
Yeah. So, We Pepper Girl Rappers, 1988, Heat It Up, got to number 21.
Very repetitive, has a lot of scratchy music, and I can't understand them in it. I have no idea. Bar when they say Heat It Up, I have no idea what they're saying.
And then 1988 as well, We Rule, number 6.
This would have been my favourite out of the two, but not going to lie, like, they're very, like, that's a fine line. That favourite, we'll say that loosely. It's quite fast-paced, and the reason I prefer this one is the chorus isn't awful. But again, I can't really understand what they're saying.
Which may be as well why they didn't quite hit it off.
The way they rapped was just a bit too fast, and their words are very close together, where you're kind of like, is that one word? Is that two words? Not quite sure.
Okay. Moving on then to Sarah Brightman.
So this is where I was like, oh, I've got something to say. She's basically someone that is a soloist and maybe couldn't make it just on her own, so had all these other people pulled in. This was my first thoughts, by the way, doing this, how I went about it. So, like, she kind of saw what she could do with other people. She's very talented. And the first song I had, I was like, okay, right. Got to the second song, I was like, whoa! That's not what I heard just then. And then I started realising she's very musical theatre, opera, very classical, works with Andrew Lloyd Webber a lot. So I feel like it's more Sarah Brightman and Andrew Lloyd Webber. And then with others, a lot of it is musical based, especially like she does a lot for Phantom of the Opera. And like I say, she's very talented. And it was just mesmerizing to listen to these songs.
Okay. So Sarah Brightman from Burke and Hampstead in Hertfordshire, active since 1978. She's a singer, actress, and dancer. And her background or her genre is classical, operatic, and pop. Yeah.
She's an opera singer.
Yeah. I'd use pop loosely as well, but she was in the pop charts, I suppose, is So at 11, Sarah successfully auditioned for the Tring Park School for the Performing Arts, and then she went on to Elmhurst Ballet School in Camberley, and then the Arts Educational School in Chiswick. And then finally, the Royal College of Music in Kensington. In 1973, aged 13, she made her theatrical debut in the musical I and Albert at Piccadilly Theatre. And then in 1976, she was recruited into Arlene Phillips' troupe Hot Gossip. In 1978, the group had a hit, or disco hit, should I say, with I lost my heart to a starship trooper. Following a brief time with Pan's people on Top of the Pops, she went solo and released several disco singles under her own label, Whisper Records, such as Not Having That and her version of My Boyfriend's Back.
How old is she at this point? Because she started out at 13. She can't be much older than that.
It's probably, I don't know.
Because I'm just thinking, was she really that young? Like in the video that I watched of her in Hot Gossip, but then the video didn't really show her.
So 1973, she was 13. In 1976, at 16, she joined Hot Gossip.
That's mad.
In 1978, the group had their hit. So she'd have been 18.
Okay. Getting older girl.
And then in 1979, she released her singles.
Right.
Under her own label. She then appeared on the... Sorry, in 1979, she appeared on the soundtrack of the film The World is Full of Married Men with the song Madam Hyde. And then in 1981, Brightman went into the musical theatre starring in Cat, which we spoke about last week with Barbara Dixon and Elaine Page. And she was Jemima. And then she was Kate in The Pirates of Penzance. In 1984, she married composer Andrew Lloyd Webber, who was behind...
So that's how they've got together with so many songs.
So he was behind the musical Cats, which is obviously where they met. Mm-hmm. And then he cast her in his new musical, The Phantom of the Opera, opposite Michael Crawford, who was in the TV show Some Mothers Do Have 'Em. In 1985, she recorded Pie Jesu, with Paul Miles Kingston from Andrew Lloyd Webber's musical Requiem. By 1990, Brightman and Lloyd Webber had separated. And in 1992, she performed with Jose Carreras for the opening of the Barcelona Olympic Games, singing the theme tune Amigas para Siempre.
I watched that video. Games
Forever. Whiteman has released 12 studio albums between 1988 to 2018, but is best known for her musicals. Her duet with Andrea Bocelli in 1998 on Time to Say Goodbye was Germany's best-selling single of all time.
Wow. That's, well, I mean, it's Germany, but I feel like for that type of music, and I don't know what language it's sung in.
In 2022, Brightman received a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame for her musical performances.
I think she's done a lot of musicals, hasn't she?
So again, a bit like Elaine Page and Barbara Dixon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Her background is musicals, and that's where she's really made her name. And that is really where she's made her inroad into.
And then I guess because
music charts.
Yeah, because she's done the musicals, the musical, the musical songs that have put her into the charts anyway, isn't it?
But her first one was more of a disc.
Oh yeah, that's disco what I mean.
Stroke pop, and that's probably where the pop come in was with Hot Gossip.
And to be fair, when you were talking and saying about it, I was like, oh yeah, that first one is a complete difference from the rest.
So, 1978, I Lost My Heart to a Starship Trooper, which, as I say, was with Hot Gossip, and that got to number 6.
Okay, it's very futuristic, it's slow with a build-up.
Okay. 1985, Pierre Jesu, I don't know how you want to pronounce it, It was with Paul Miles Kingston, and that got to number 3. And that was from, did I say the musical Requiem?
I don't think
you
said the
musical. Yeah, it's from the musical Requiem.
It was very classical opera, and I said, what a change. Because obviously this is like the second one I'm listening to. Beautiful voice, but I have no idea what she's singing.
Okay. 1986, The Phantom of the Opera. Obviously from the musical, The Phantom of the Opera. However, it's not with Michael Crawford. It's with Steve Harley. Mm-hmm. You said this would be a number one. Am I correct?
Yeah.
It was inside the top 10.
Yeah.
However, it was only number 7.
See, I wonder, now you said, like, I didn't know who originally was in Phantom of the Opera, but I know that Phantom of the Opera, it like was a big musical performance, and I just thought, for the time that it was, that the Phantom of the Opera might have been number one to go alongside the performance. But then I guess if it's been recorded with Steve Harley, maybe people didn't like that version. I don't know. But I've heard it anyway. I feel like it's a classic and well-known for musical theatre. Again, very opera.
In 1986, All I Ask of You with Cliff Richard got to number 3.
Really? This was just an odd duet because she's singing magnificently with her big voice and her opera style classical, and he's singing normally because it's Cliff Richard, and I just don't think the two go well together. I don't think it was a good mix of styles.
However, you put the name Cliff Richard and
you can sell us
his fans will come out and buy his songs.
Yeah,
that so, they're all in their 80s and 90s now, though, so, or 70s, sorry. 70s to 80s
now. He was like quite early on, weren't he?
He was like, he was Elvis Presley with Summer Holiday and that, the films.
Yeah.
We then come to a double A, which was in 1987, both of them with Michael Crawford, obviously. The Music of the Night and Wishing You Were Somehow Here, and that got to number, or they got to number 7.
Okay, so The Music of the Night, I recognised. She doesn't play a big part in it, and it's quite stripped back, and it builds up to that chorus again. So, and very opera, and I feel like they were quite different to one another.
Okay, we're now going into the 90s, 1992, with Amigo Para Siempre. Apologies if I've not pronounced that anyway correctly. Which in English is Friends for Life. And that was with Jose Carreras, and that got to number 11.
This is a very good duet. The only thing that puts me off it is it's not in English, so I'm like, what are you even singing about? But I think they work quite well together.
Okay. And then finally, 1997. Time to Say Goodbye, Conte Partirio. That was with Andrea Bocelli. You said it would be number one.
Yeah.
Sarah Brightman hasn't had a number one yet. It was, I can say, inside the top 10.
Right.
It was inside the top 5.
Right.
It was inside the top 3.
Right.
It charted at number 2.
I thought that would do it, you know. That was my favourite for her. It's an amazing song to end on. I think it's just so beautifully sung. And I just thought because I know the name Andrea Bocelli, I thought it would be a big song based on him. So I thought that might have bumped it to number 1. Plus, it's just beautiful. Apparently not.
No.
I'm shocked she hasn't had any number 1s, just because of the... But maybe it is because it's that musical theatre and that it doesn't sell as much. But I just thought...
Well, it sells enough, but not...
Well, yeah, but not that many. Yeah, I'm shocked that she didn't have a number 1. I'm very shocked because I had the most songs for her ish.
Yeah, yeah.
And I feel like her songs were quite big because of the musical theatre, but apparently not. So let's find those two.
So let's move on to Womack and Womack, who you've also said may have a number one.
I have. I've gone for R&B with these. I want to say they're married, but I'm so sorry if they're siblings. There's definitely a relation to them. The woman is much better than the man. I'll put that out there. Their music's very hit and miss and doesn't all follow suit, so I'm not sure what they were about.
Okay. So, Womack and Womack, Linda and Cecil Womack.
Cecil, I think that's a great name. That name should come back. Cecil? Not good if
they're from Cleveland, Ohio. They've been active since 1983. They are singers, and their genre is R&B, soul, funk, and dance.
Okay.
So Linda is the daughter of soul singer Sam Cooke, who you have had.
Him.
If you remember, he was shot in 1964.
I do remember his name.
So Linda met Cecil when she was 8 and he was 13. And Cecil's older brother was the singer Bobby Womack.
Not heard of Bobby Womack.
So Cecil married Mary Wells in 1967, while Linda Cooke, as she was then, wrote music, including co-writing Bobby Womack's hit, Woman's Gotta Have It. In 1977, Cecil broke up with his wife, and the reason they broke up is she was discovered having an affair with his brother, Curtis Womack.
There's a lot of Womacks going about, isn't there?
There's a lot of Womacks.
Goodness me.
So, yeah, so they got divorced.
Family tree.
Yeah, they got divorced in 1977. Meanwhile, Bobby Womack became Linda's stepfather after marrying Sam Cooke's widow, Barbara.
How big a difference in age gap do these brothers have? Because how's he marrying if Linda is like 5 years younger than Cecil? And then Bobby is Cecil's older brother and he's married Linda's mum. How old is Bobby?
So I need to.
So then he'd already made it at that point, hadn't he? So there must be a gap. Or they're like half siblings or something. Or that widower had a crisis.
So Bobby Womack. He was born in 1944. Cecil Womack. Was born in 1947. So 3 years.
And yet there's 5 years difference. So there's an 8 year difference between Linda and her stepdad.
Yeah.
And her mum's got to be a bit older because they're 8. To be a mum.
Yeah. Yeah, well, Sam Cooke was. Unless Sam Cooke married a younger lady. Which
go on, what year was Linda, what's her name, born then?
She was born in 1953.
So that's 10 years. 11. That's not too bad when you put it
out. Okay. So, yeah, so Bobby Womack obviously became Linda's stepdad, which obviously then meant, although they already knew each other you know,
they probably hadn't really crossed paths fully for
more through the Womack for his, you know, singing, and obviously Sam Cooke would have been that. So that sort of pushed Cecil and Linda together, and shortly after they got married themselves. And in 1983, Cecil and Linda began performing and recording together as Womack and Womack. And they signed to Elektra Records and released the album Love Wars, with their debut single TKO, which charted at number 87 on the Billboard R&B chart. In 1988, they had their most successful single with their own written track called Teardrops, which reached number one in Belgium, Netherlands, and New Zealand.
And the UK.
And was a top 10 hit throughout Europe. The single has since been covered by Elton John and Katie Lang, Cliff Richard, and Candy Stratton, or Staten, and also Joss Stone. So the couple released 10 albums between 1983 and 2006, and then Cecil died in 2013, aged 65. The couple had 7 children together. 3 of their daughters have formed the group the Womack Sisters. So, Womack
lived on the Womack.
1984, Love Wars got to number 14.
Very quiet until the chorus, not much content going on there.
1988, Teardrops, you said number one.
Stand by it.
I can let you know it was in the top 10.
You get my hopes up with, I can let you know.
I can also let you know it's in the top 5.
Of course you can, because it's going to be a number one, isn't it, Dad?
Teardrops got to number 3.
No, it didn't.
It did.
What are people's ears?
That's good. That's number it. 3.
Yeah, but it's not a number one, is it?
No, you still want him to
anything
come.
Anything below a, when I think a song's number one, anything below a number one is just rubbish. Especially if I'm very, very, I don't know what the word is, but I stand by it. I'm very convinced it's a number one.
I'd rather Jack was number 8. Oh, that's good. Yeah, that's good. Teardrops, number 3. Oh, what a disgrace.
Yeah, because I really wanted it to be a number 1. So that is a disgrace. How dare it not get to number 1? But I also recognise it. Oh, it's just a really, really, really good song. It's like an all-round. It's so catchy. And it's a sing-along. I really thought I had it with that one, you know.
1988, Life's Just a Ball Game, number 32.
This one's slow. It's got to focus on the lyrics and vocals, and it tells a story.
Okay. And then 1989, Celebrate the World, got to number 19.
This was my favourite out of the 4. I would have chosen Teardrops to be my favourite, but obviously could have recognised that. I'll try and steer clear. Gets you moving, and it's an all-rounder song.
Okay. Moving on to Roberta Flack.
Yes, so this was the other one that I was like, she's a bit of more of a soloist and has people with her. I've gone with R&B, blues, and jazz, and she's got good vocals. I feel she chose people that she can work with well and the right people for the style of song that she was doing with them. She's also good on her own, because there's a couple where, like at the beginning, I feel she was more of a soloist. I don't think she was really with anyone.
Okay. So Roberta Flack from Black Mountain, North Carolina, active since 1968. She's a singer, musician, played the keyboards, and she is R&B, jazz, and soul, not blues.
Oh.
But well done. So Flack was 9 when she started taking piano lessons. And at 15, she was awarded a music scholarship at Howard University, making her one of the youngest students ever to enroll there. While there, she became an assistant conductor to the choir. Her direction of Ada received a standing ovation from the university students. And at 19, she graduated and began graduate studies in music. But the sudden death of her father meant she was forced to take a job teaching music and English in North Carolina. She also taught piano lessons privately, and during time, her evenings and weekends when she accompanied opera singers at the piano. So by giving private lessons, she got to then play alongside
like
singers and what have you. So and
that, yeah, that's not a bad way. As much as it's probably not what she wanted to do.
No, it was often because of her father dying, and it was a needs and a must rather than
a want and a desire. Yeah. But she still managed to go somewhere with the music as well.
Yeah. So over time, music career began to take shape during evenings and weekends. As I say, when she was obviously with these opera singers at the piano. So Les McGann, an American jazz pianist and vocalist, discovered Flack singing and playing jazz in Washington and arranged an audition for her with Atlantic Records, during which she played 42 songs in 3 hours for their producer, Joel Dorn. Yeah. She then recorded 39 of those songs, demos, and 3 months later, Atlantic recorded Flack's debut album, First Take, in just 10 hours from the music they already had. She went
from,
to an audition.
What was already?
Songs. Of those, they said, right, we want a demo of 39 of those. So,
yeah.
Songs for whatever reason they discounted, and then of those 39, they made an album from the, obviously the best ones that they could work with,
and they did that in 10 hours.
Yeah, so the album was released in June 1969, and then in 1971, Flack participated in the legendary Soul to Soul concert film by Dennis Sanders, alongside Ike and Tina Turner, Wilson Pickett, Les McCann, who'd introduced her, got her into the music business, and Santana, among others. Her debut single, a cover of Will You Love Me Tomorrow, reached number 76 on the Billboard Hot 100 in 1972. And her Atlantic recordings did not sell very well until that was until actor director Clint Eastwood chose a song from First Take for his soundtrack of his directorial debut film Play Misty for Me. The track The First Time Ever I Saw Your Face, written by Ewan McCall, became the biggest hit of the year of 1972. And spent 6 weeks at number one and earned Flack a gold disc for sales of in excess of 1 million. On the back of that, the album First Take also went to number one, selling 1.9 million copies in the US. So all from it going from not that well, you know, very slowly, and probably would have, you know, died off and, you know, been one that maybe people would have picked up later on or whatever, but yeah, it looked like that had gone. And then this one chance of a big actor at the time, who's now gone into directing, chose a song for his film soundtrack And that song went on to be big, as I say, the biggest of that year. And that in turn helped the album.
Mad how one thing can change everything in it.
So Eastwood, who paid just $2,000 for the use of track, remained an admirer of Flack and friend. Sorry, an admirer and friend of Flack's ever since. In 1973, Flack scored another number one with Killing Me Softly, with his song, which was written by Charles Fox, Norman Gimbel, and Laurie Liberman. Flack won two Grammys due to the track in 1974 for Record of the Year and Best Pop Vocal Performance by a Female. And then in 1980, she released two singles from her 1972 album, Roberta Flack and Donny Hathaway. And then in 1983, she started working with Peebo Bryson and had more chart success with their duet of Tonight I Celebrate My Love, which got to number 5 on the Billboard R&B chart and number 4 on the Billboard Adult Contemporary chart. In 1999, a star with her name was placed on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, and she also gave a concert in South Africa, which Nelson Mandela attended. Flack has released 18 studio albums between 1969 and 2018. So, 1972, the first time I ever saw your face. Got to number 14.
Ooh, okay. Well, I recognise this one. I feel like it's a bit of a ballad and very beautifully sung.
In 1972, Where Is the Love with Donny Hathaway. Got to number 29.
This has a good beat. It's catchy and it's a very swaying song.
1973. Killing Me Softly with his song got to number 6.
Okay, so I said, is this a cover or being covered? As I recognised it a lot, but I don't know this version. Obviously, you said that it was like written by someone else and performed by someone else before, but I don't know.
It wasn't performed by someone else. It was just written. Yeah, it was written by others, like they do now. People write songs and offer them out.
And then she
got it, whether they offered it to her. Or others turned it down before it was offered to her. I don't know. Or they wrote specifically for her. But yeah, they wrote and she sang it.
Okay. So I think this has been covered then, but I didn't go into who it might have been covered by because I recognise it. But like I said, I didn't know.
Didn't the Black Eyed Peas do it or someone like that?
Killing Me Softly with his song?
Yeah. I don't know.
Not the Black Eyed Peas. No.
I don't know who done it.
I don't know. And I didn't look it up. It's got a good build up. I do like this version to the other one that I had in my head, but like I say, I don't know who the other one is or could have been.
I'm seeing if there is Fugees. The Fugees.
Fugees, okay. That might be why I know it.
Yeah, it's the Fugees. Okay, 1980, Back Together again with Donny Hathaway. It's on the same album as the one that was released in 1972, but I guess on the back of whatever. It's not like she's had any success in between, unless she has in America. But yeah, this was released from that same album as Where Is the Love, and this one got to number 3.
Long intro. Long song. It's not the best. Music is very loud.
And I've just seen Laurie Liberman did release it.
Right. I don't know who that is.
We're talking 1971. So I don't even know who she is. But that was the first version released. And then Roberta Flack, and then Fugees of Killing Me Softly with his song. Anyway, moving on. 1983, Tonight I Celebrate My Love with Peebo Bryson. That got to number 2.
This was my favourite. It was a love song and the vocals worked very well together.
Okay. Moving on to Pepsi and Shirley.
Yes. I've gone with pop for them. They met on a set of a video or was backing singers for Spandau Ballet or Duran Duran. I can't fully remember, but I have heard of them. Martin Kemp's still married to Shirley, isn't he? They work well together and you can tell that they're really good friends. I thought, because I've heard of them through you talking, it's not even going to be Spandau Ballet or Duran Duran, is it? But through you talking, I thought they'd have more songs.
Okay. So Pepsi and Shirley, who is Helen DeMack and Shirley Holloman. They're from Paddington, London, and Watford, Hertfordshire. So Helen is from Paddington, who is Pepsi, and Shirley is from Watford, who is Shirley. Oh. They're singers, and they are pop or dance pop. And they've been active since 1985. So, Shirley Holloman became a dancer for her then-boyfriend's Andrew Ridgely band, Wham.
Nah, I thought, after I read all that out, I was like, nah, I'm wrong, it's Wham.
Yeah. And as the band became more successful, she went from dancer to backing singer along with D.C. Lee, a friend of hers.
Right.
D.C. Lee then left for her own boyfriend, Paul Weller's band, The Style Council. Right. And Helen DeMack was brought in as a replacement. When George Michael disbanded Wham for a solo career, Helen DeMack was also looking at pursuing a solo career herself. However, Holloman convinced her that it would be better to proceed as a duo. And then in 1987, they released their debut single, Heartache, which was produced by Phil Fearon of Galaxy, who we've spoken about.
Yep.
With the single reaching number 2 on the US Dance Club singles songs chart, as well as reaching number 2 in Switzerland, Belgium and Netherlands.
That's not bad going for two backing dancers / singers, yeah. Is it?
And it also got to number 3 in Ireland. Follow-up single, Goodbye Stranger, was a top 10 hit in the UK, but subsequent releases were commercially unsuccessful. While the debut album, All Right Now, only made number 69 on the UK album chart. While their second and final album, Change, released in 1991, didn't even chart. Although the lead single, Someday, was written and produced by George Michael after Shirley had got hold of him to help them out, hoping that he might boost their ratings and But it flopped outside the top 40 at number 78. The duo returned as backing singers in 2000 on Jerry Halliwell's hit Bag It Up, which was number 1 in the UK. Shirley Holloman married Wham rivals Spandau Ballet member Martin Kemp, Spandau Ballet member / bassist Martin Kemp in 1988 after George Michael had given her his number. And they have since had, obviously, children, of which one of them is Ronan Kemp, who's well in the TV business himself now.
They can thank George Michael then.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's mad.
Yeah. So, Pepsi and Shirley, you never went for a number one with these.
No, because I only had two. I didn't think they'd be that big. Because I half knew that they didn't start as like any sort of singers.
Okay. How many times do we say about, you know, someone leaves the band or whatever, goes out alone, and the first song is a number one? Robbie Williams. There's been others we've mentioned on this, but
this is a bit different, isn't it? Robbie Williams, we'll find out, like a backing singer.
Boy George.
They weren't backing singers, though. Pepsi and Shirley weren't known, were they? So they didn't have a following already.
Do you know how big Wham were?
But everyone knew that they're backing dancers / singers.
They knew Pepsi and Shirley, yes. And obviously she was married to Spandau Ballet's Martin Kemp.
But I didn't know what time all of this happened in the timeline, did I?
1987, Heartache was a top 10 hit for Pepsi and Shirley. It was inside the top 5. It was inside the top 3. It was inside the top 2. Pepsi and Shirley in 1987 with their song Heartache reached number 2.
Thank you. You get me all irate. You get a kick out of it sometimes, you do, don't you? I'm not taking away from the song. I just didn't think they would have had a number one. And I'm
a number 2? That's as good as a number one, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's not quite, is it?
No.
You probably didn't get a... I swear when you get a number one, you get a little UK top 40 little trophy thing. Don't know whether you did back in the day, but I'm pretty sure you do now. Heartache was upbeat, fun, music is louder, and it's very 80s. It was my favourite out of the two.
Okay. And in 1987 also, Goodbye Stranger was released, and that was also a top 10 hit at number 9.
So they've not done bad. It's a head bopper, bit shouty, and can fall into the background.
Okay. So we go on to Hilary Lester.
Rene and Renato.
Yes.
Yeah, that confused me. Why two different names? Why Hilary Lester and Rene and Renato? But they are a duet, so it is Rene and Renato. So it's just all very odd. And they're a very odd couple, I think. The video was a bit cringe. And I just went for classical.
Okay. So little is known about Hilary Lester, other than she was Rene in the duo Rene and Renato. However, Renato Pagliari was rumoured to be the voice behind Wall's commercials for their Just One Cornetto.
Give it to me. I heard that.
Yeah. So he was rumoured. It's never been confirmed, but it's also never been denied, which makes you think it is.
Yeah, because it's him. Not.
But it is only a rumour. Even after all these years, I still couldn't find anything that said it wasn't him or it was him, even now. So, which was their adverts for the ice lolly Cornetto. Mm-hmm. The duo were put together in 1982 to record the song Save Your Love. The video, however, didn't even feature Hillary, as a model replaced her in the uncomfortable watch of a dodgy bed scene. Now, I can't tell you anymore because I haven't. It was one of those songs that was almost novelty song sort of thing. And I can't say that the video, especially back then anyway, had much airplay. Because we didn't have MTV or anything like that, and it had a dodgy so-called bed scene, and she wasn't even in that.
Makes it even weirder.
So yeah. So the record company was keen to capitalize on the duo's success and released a further 2 singles. Just One More Kiss and Jesus Loves Us All. However, both flopped and the duo ended as quickly as they started. So,
okay.
So Renato, although Italian-born, resided in the West Midlands and was a big Aston Villa fan and was friends with then-manager Juan Atkinson, who once invited him to sing Nessun Dorma during the half-time of a match that they had been abysmal, evidently, in. And at the end of it, he goes, "That is a great performance, unlike what you're having out on the football pitch."
Okay, a bit brutal.
That was his half-time team talk, in a sense. So, yeah.
Going in it.
Yeah. So, although Hilary Lester returned to a normal private life after the fame died down, and as I say, no one knows what's happened to her, a bit like the Reynolds girls, Renato continued singing on a cruise ship and at his son's restaurant in Tamworth. So, there we go. And he even got guest spots on TV shows like Little and Large. Renato died from complications during surgery on a brain tumour when he was 69. And Juan Atkinson has since gone on to say that only Luciano Pavarotti could sing Nessun Dorma better than Renato. So there we go. So, Rene and Renato.
Yeah.
Had one song.
Well, yeah.
It was in 1982.
I feel they didn't last long enough for anymore. And then it all gets a bit confusing after that.
Yeah. However, in 1982, Save Your Love was the Christmas number one. It was number one above David Bowie's Drummer Boy. It was number one above David Essex's A Winter's Tale.
I have no idea what they're even singing. There are good vocals that you can tell them. To be number one at Christmas.
Yeah.
Come on now.
Yeah.
Has it ever been played since?
Probably not, no. And that is why it's a bit of a novelty one song. And it's a bit of a Joe Dulcie moment where really that is what the British public are buying over other songs.
Mad.
Yeah. So there you go. You did not get that number one. Right.
Anyone have got that number one?
We will now move on to Kim Appleby.
Right. No.
Well, Mel and Kim, but Kim Appleby.
Okay, I've done these as two separate people. Because I did, when you sent me the list,
duets. Did Kim Appleby have a duet with anyone?
Did Suzanne Fassbender written on paper? Hey, but you didn't write that.
Okay.
You didn't write that. So. Yeah. So when you wrote it to me and you wrote Mel and Kim and wrote their songs and then wrote Kim Appleby.
And you thought of Walking Around the Christmas Tree, Mel Smith and Kim Wilde, correct?
Mel and Kim, pop and hip hop, I went with. They're another duo that work well together. But I swear you said about Rocking Around the Christmas Tree, which when you first gave me Mel and Kim, I thought about a female duo because I have heard of, like, I'm sure Mel and Kim have been mentioned before in the past. But then as soon as you mentioned Rocking Around the Christmas Tree, I changed my expectation thinking, well, this is going to be a funny week because they were a bit of an odd duo. So explain yourself. Wind me up. Thank you.
Hang on.
Do you want me to say what I wrote about Kim Appleby?
Yeah.
Because it'll make you laugh now. This is all I wrote about her. I'm not seeing a duet. Now okay. I get why.
So, Mel and Kim, not the comic relief duo who released Rocking Around a Christmas Tree as comedian Mel Smith and singer Kim Wilde. This is Mel and Kim, Melanie and Kim Appleby. Yeah. They are from London. They have been active since 1986. They are singers and they are dance pop. So, Mel and Kim were an English pop duo consisting of the singers Melanie and Kim Appleby, who were originally managed by Alan Whitehead, the drummer in Marmalade. The demos got them signed. Their demos got them signed to Supreme Records, whose president, Nick East, put them in touch with the producers, Stock, Aitken and Waterman.
Popping up again.
Yep. Kim said on meeting the trio how they were shocked that they were much older than they had imagined and were expecting some young, groovy guy to be behind the track Say I'm Your Number One, which was produced and wrote for Princess, which obviously we've had in this series, and was obviously the song that made them think, yeah, we can work with these people, because that's obviously the sort of song they were looking at having themselves, is what I got out of that. A sedate sound pop track called System was intended as their debut single, but the producers were unhappy with it and it became the B-side to Showing Out Get Fresh at the Weekend. This was following Pete Waterman getting to know the sisters a little bit better, and he was convinced that their music should reflect their feisty and streetwise personalities. And it was him that then went back to the other two and said, this song we've written for them, as I say, called System, it's not right for them. It's not what we should have. So hence that became the beat. And the song that was obviously then put out was Showing Out Get Fresh at the Weekend, which was obviously more upbeat and not as sedate as the original on the back of this. So then following the success of their debut single, their manager, Alan Whitehead, was sacked. I guess they then went more with Stock Aitken and Waterman, feeling that
I feel like you'd go down the one that has a bit more of a jive to it, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Going with the more upbeat version would be the way to go, I think, because I feel like it's a bit more commercial. Like, obviously, I've not heard the other one, but I feel like more upbeat is a bit more commercial.
It's probably out there. So the change of song, which Pete Waterman was behind, saying their sound needs to have attitude. And although the sisters at first were unhappy with System being scrapped, they soon knew that the producers knew what they were doing and obviously then sacked their manager and went full blown with them. Their next single, Respectable, sold in excess of 800,000 copies in America, where it reached number one on the US Dance Club Songs chart. And the single was also a chart success, hitting number one in Australia, Belgium, Finland, Netherlands, New Zealand, Switzerland, and in West Germany, or Germany as we now know. And the sisters then became well-known celebrities in Europe, especially in Britain, and were as known as much for their visual style as they were for their music. And their third single, FLM, which is an acronym for Fun, Love and Money, but was also a play on the Sea Sisters' frequent use of the expression effing lovely, mate. during the recording sessions of their album. The single was a top 10 success in Belgium and Ireland. And the video showed footage of their Montreal Festival performance, with the sisters represented by a pair of lookalikes, while the media speculated that Mel was being treated for cancer. Kim has later said that both her and Mel were devastated by the video and had not been consulted. And Nick East, who was obviously to do with their record company, who put them in touch with Stock Aitken and Waterman, has since said that the video was a big mistake.
Oh.
In 1988, a new single...
To be fair, why wouldn't you include, like, the people that are singing it?
Well, exactly, but it's because she was going through cancer and they obviously felt...
So is that what that was confirmed?
Well, yeah, I will come to that now.
Right, okay.
So in 1988, a new video... in 1988, a new single, That's the Way It Is, was released, with Mel discharging herself from hospital to record her vocals for the track. With the B-side... You Changed My Life, composed by the sisters during Mel's treatment, and was given to the producers as a possible single. The Way It Is was used as on the soundtrack of Coming to America, starring Eddie Murphy, and was a top 10 hit in Belgium, Finland, Netherlands, and Switzerland. Their album, FLM, released in 1987, reached number 3 in the UK, but was number 2 in Australia and New Zealand. In 1988, they were nominated for a Brit Award for Best British Breakthrough Act. However, they lost out on the award to Wet, Wet, Wet. The duo did several TV appearances while Mel underwent treatment, including Wogan to promote Cancer Week. And after Mel's chemotherapy, the duo appeared on Good Morning Britain to promote the need for teenage cancer wards in British hospitals. Work on the second album was stopped by Stock Aitken and Waterman while Mel received treatment, and the sisters withdrew from publicity while writing songs for the second album. Several of these songs appeared on Kim's debut solo album following the sad passing of Mel in January 1990 from cancer. Kim Appleby went on to have a solo career with her debut album released in 1990 called Kim Appleby, with lead single Don't Worry written with former Bros guitar bassist Craig Logan, and was a top 10 hit across Europe and was even number 1 in Zimbabwe.
Oh, wow.
She released two albums, Kim Appleby, which charted at number 23 in the UK, and Breakaway, which charted at number 41 in the charts in 1993. However, her biggest success was obviously as a duo with her sister. So, Mel and Kim, 1986, showing out.
There's a number one.
Showing out, Get Fresh at the Weekend was your prediction for a number one. And yes. I can tell you it was in the top 10, their what debut the single. Take? It was why good enough to be in the top 5.
Yep.
It was in the top 3.
Yeah, okay.
1986, Mel and Kim reached... Number 3 was showing out Get Fresh at the Weekend.
I'm pretty sure all the ones that I said were number 1 have got number 3. Number 3 week. It gets you moving. It's very simple, but it's very catchy, and it does the job, I think.
1987, their follow-up single, Respectable, was a number 1.
Do you know what? That's my favourite, so I'll take that. But do you know why I didn't want to put it as a number 1? Because I recognised it and I thought, oh, not all the ones that I recognise and that I know without Dad telling me or me knowing that Dad listened. For sake, why do I always doubt things? Anyway, it was my favourite. Very catchy, repetitive. And Are You Ready? I wrote, comes across very chart-topping.
It's
a good beat, yeah.
1987. FLN M, Fun Love Money, or Effin' Lovely Mate, whichever you want to go with. Matt got to number 7.
Why do you say it like that? Good beat. The lyrics don't match the music, though. They didn't really work.
And in 1988, their final single, really, unfortunately, That's the Way It Is, was also another. So all their singles got to the top 10 because it was number 10.
Oh, okay. So that's good for them, isn't it? Like, yeah, they did well considering. I thought this one would be more 90s. I feel like you could work out to this. It's got a good beat, good to move to, and it's repetitive.
Okay. And then Kim Appleby on her own in the 1990s. Obviously went on to have a little bit of a solo career. And I have seen her at Rewind. Okay. So 1990, Don't Worry, got to number 2.
Okay, chorus is the best part of it. It's a bit of a background song until the chorus, though. So that's quite a surprise to me.
1991, GLAD, Glad. That got to number 10.
This was my favourite out of these because obviously I thought that she was a whole separate person that we'd be talking about. It's a proper sing song. Very catchy. And
1991, Mama, the only single that Kim Appleby released that wasn't a top 10 when you think of her singles with her sister.
Oh, yeah, when you think of with her sister as well, yeah.
It got to number 19.
It's not bad, though, is it?
Still top 20.
It's stripped back. The beat's been taken away, but it does slowly build up, and I feel like it's just more of a mellow song.
Yeah. And then, obviously, she probably released some more singles after this, but they obviously didn't chart, and that was...
Yeah.
The end of her music career, I suppose, but very sad. So, did Dad influence Daughter this week? It was a weird one because it was even like Sarah Brightman, her songs were different because of duets. You know, the one with Hot Gossip, more pop, you've already said about the Cliff Richard one, was not really, you know. And then you had some really good ones. And you had different genres with her as well, because obviously some were from theatre and some were obviously not the majority with theatre. But you know, so we'll start with Susan Fassbender, who, as I say, was with Kay Russell on Twilight Cafe, really, which was her only song. And another sad ending as well, when she committed suicide at just 32.
That was a miss.
I thought it would be. I mean, it only got to number 21 at the time, so it's not a song
that not really a big
defines song. The 80s, really, and you don't really hear of it still now. So the Reynolds Girls.
They were a hit.
One hit wonder?
Yep.
We Papagel Rappers. I think I already know what that is.
Yeah, they weren't with me.
Sarah Brightman.
Right, so she's a hit, but not because I'll listen to her. Like, she's not someone that I will stick on because I'm really not a classical opera girl. But her talent, I do think if you were going to listen to that type of music, she'd be someone that you'd have to put on. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Womack and Womack.
They were a hit.
I thought.
Were they the ones that were a bit hit and miss? Yeah. So they're a bit hit and miss, but out of the four songs, two of them were very up my street.
Teardrops and really Celebrate the World.
Yeah.
Roberta Flack.
She is another hit. I did really enjoy those. I really do think I have a thing for a bit of jazz, you know.
Mm. Here you go, sing. Mm. Pepsi and Shirley.
They're a miss. I was just making sure I was saying the right one. They're a miss. They only had two songs though as well. I just didn't find
Reynolds Girls only had one, and you thought they were a hit, you know.
Yeah, but vibe.
Rene and Renato, I'm guessing you love their song. Christmas number one, you'll have it on every Christmas now.
No, we'll not. They're a miss. Complete miss.
Hilary Lester, whatever happened to her? Just imagine that she's now living next door to the Reynolds girls and they chat every summer over the hedge. A one hit.
Wouldn't even know.
Mel and Kim and Kim Appleby. I'll put them all together.
Right. No, I'll put them separately.
Well, they're not. Because Kim Appleby was in the 90s and a soloist, which is why as a soloist at the time, I've just put her in here because it's part of the story and it's only right because some of those songs, as I said, were written with Mel when she was practically dying, you know, so.
Yeah, we're going to do them separately because that's how I've done it.
Okay, well.
And also, because they're not the same. If I'd put them as both the same, I'd be like, yeah, they're this, but they're not. Mel and Kim are a hit. I like Mel and Kim's songs, but Kim Appleby was a miss. Didn't like her songs.
That's fine, because Kim Appleby was just an add-on to the story of Mel and Kim.
Yeah, well,
and had
I like Mel and Kim.
Had Mel not sadly passed, Kim Appleby would have carried on as Mel and Kim. It was only because of circumstances that she went as obviously solo.
Yeah.
And as I say, it was that was in the 1990s. You wouldn't have even had her had it.
No, reason.
So
yeah.
So I will take that as a good thing. So we've got
You had nine.
One, two,
and in three, my four, head.
Five. Out of nine.
But five out of ten for mine.
I'm not including Kim Appleby because she was a soloist in her own right in the 90s.
So I'm putting her as separate. She was a soloist in her own right.
But she wouldn't have been on the pod had it not been for the Mel and Kim beginning and had, as I say, the sad passing of Melanie
and
Kim Appleby as a soloist would not have happened either because they would have been quite happy going along.
Going
as
on
the
together,
sisters,
they
Mel
wouldn't
and
have. Yeah, yeah.
But yeah. So, but no, I'm happy with that. And that brings us to the end of
the 80s.
We've done the groups, the bands, we've done the male. We've done the females, and we've also now done the duets, which of what, you know, those we hadn't already touched on. So that was it. That was the 80s.
Wow. Well, I have learned a lot. And I will say, well, actually, I'll give you a summary of the whole thing when we speak in a couple of weeks. With our summary, well, with your summary of series 5, and I'll let you know my own little summary about how I have perceived the 80s, taken it all on, you know, how I've been influenced by it.
Okay, well, I'll give a summary, obviously, of this series.
Yeah.
Between us, we can decide what we do next. Do we go to the 90s? Because obviously you were born in the 90s, so it's not like you know
the
90s.
Well, I'm mid-90s, aren't I? I was only five at the end of the 90s. But then it's like you, isn't it? You're not 70s, but you were born earlier in the 70s than I was the 90s.
You're not really into music until your teens.
So that's what I mean. So, like, I'm a very noughties girl. Like, that's where my music is. Mine's not.
So really we could go 90s, not to the extreme of this one, because even I...
You're not as into it, I feel like.
You know, I love the 80s. At 90s, I was raising a family, so it was a bit...
I feel like... Well, obviously, we'll talk behind the scenes.
Yeah, and the other option is we go back to the 80s, and the group... The artists that you've said thumbs up to, because I wouldn't make you listen to people you've obviously already said, is we then go to the albums just from the 80s, so obviously those that have lasted longer.
Yeah.
We won't do their albums that have been later on. We will just do albums that were released in the 80s.
And see where their albums got.
And see what you think of their other songs.
Like their albums.
Because okay. There were some good albums in the 80s that are now, funny enough,
yeah, they're ones that have been very
re-released because they're coming up to like 40th anniversary. I mean, I went to the
you're going to a lot 30th of, concerts, or 40th,
Aha and Hunting High and Low.
Yeah.
And there's been others. Lexicon of Love, ABC have toured, which we've also gone and seen. And I saw the other day that Thompson Twins are re-releasing a commemorative In the Gap, which was their big album of the 80s. Yeah. So there were some big albums.
I feel like
there were obviously none that others that weren't. So I think we'd probably say the album's got to be in, what, the top 20 or the top 10 even?
Yeah, it depends how many albums there are as well.
Yeah, and all, yeah.
Because so, if they're a band, say, that started from 1980 and went all the way through and kept going through, they're going to have... And like I think we realise as well, there's a lot of artists that release an album every year, isn't there?
Yeah, yeah. So we'd only go for the ones that you liked. There would be no point... I'd hate to listen to an album of someone I don't even like.
You imagine making me listen to like the Selector
episode. Or... I was just literally about to say episode one, you've got Selector and The Cure, which is annoying because you're not going to listen to The Cure. Yeah. So because you turned down The Cure. Kate Bush, I think you said no to her, didn't you? Not Kate Bush.
Was it Kate? Not no. Like Kate Bush.
There was someone big you said no
like
to.
Kate Bush. Many.
I can't remember who it was.
Many.
There was someone big. There was someone
there's
big.
Lots that Yvonne, there's a lot that Yvonne's been shocked about.
Yeah, there's a few that I was shocked, and there was one lady. Kim Wilde, you said no to. You said no to Kim Wilde.
Yeah. I have seen her live as well, though, and she was good live, but only with a couple of songs, I still wouldn't listen to everything.
You know, Kate Bush, you said no to.
Yeah, I never said no. That's what I said. Oh,
sorry. I would not listen to Kate Bush. It was Kate Bush. Kate Bush and Kim Wilde. Two that you said no to. Donna Summer.
You know what? Donna Summer came in my head. Summer, when you were talking about big ones. I was like, I'm sure she was a big one. But
Annie Lennox. Not that she was really a big artist, soloist. She was more 90s, I think, for her main album. So, yeah. Okay, so we'll decide what we go, whether we do that or 90s. Forward. If we go forward. But for now, I shall say goodbye.
Yeah.
Until we just discuss your thoughts on the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
The summary of this series.
And I will, of course, be revealing who you get to listen to.
You don't have to do that.
We definitely do, Dad.
Okay.
You've not had any females from... And obviously I do the I could have easily done the noughties because that's more my music, but I feel like you know a lot of noughties, so I went for the 2010s because I know that's way out of your comfort zone.
Yeah.
Yeah, so...
Beyonce, Taylor Swift. What's the other one? Who was at Manchester when they had the...
Ariana Grande.
That's her, yeah. Not that I know, I couldn't tell you anything about her other than the Manchester thing, but yeah. So I do know a few women.
Make a decision. Obviously, yeah. I might not give you, like a Beyonce because you know her. And
well, I don't know her songs, though, but yeah.
No, but she would also have a lot of songs.
Yeah.
I mean, I liked Winding You Up with a bit of Stormzy last time. I think that was my favourite I've given you.
Yeah. Okay.
And we have found people that you do like, so come on now.
Yeah.
Play the game.
Okay. All right. We'll discuss what your thoughts of the 80s were, and I look forward to that. Until then, I shall say goodbye.
Bye, Dad.
See you.